From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Day one for legal pot in Michigan. We'll see how it's doing in Colorado.
I think some of the concerns that people have about the social cost of marijuana, they're difficult to determine even 5 years after legalization.
Michigan Republicans are moving to strip campaign finance control away from the incoming Secretary of State.
To me, this is no different than if Fort Knox was to hire John Dillinger to head of security.
Music played in Auschwitz, heard for the first time in decades.
It's filled with so much joy, so much euphoria, and then you think about that setting and that those prisoners were somehow able to be musicians and express that music.
And the murky world of the Pentagon budget. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, as of today, Michigan is the first Midwest state to allow recreational use of marijuana. What lessons could we learn from the first state that did this, Colorado? Let's talk expectations versus results with Ben Marcus of Colorado Public Radio. And it's good to have you back on Stateside, Ben.
Well, thanks for having me again.
So Michigan voters said yes to Proposal 1 on November 6th, and today is the day Michigan joins Colorado in the Legal Use of Recreational Pot Club. We know it's been legal there since 2012, but you say there's much more that isn't known about the consequences of legalizing marijuana than is known. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that the social costs are more long-term, right? We have a generation of kids who are growing up, especially in the city of Denver, where we have more than 200 recreational stores in one city alone. We just don't know what that does to a generation of people to live in a city with the easiest access, the lowest price for this drug that's really ever existed. And so there's no analogy for this anywhere else. Maybe Amsterdam's kind of the closest you get, but we just don't know what the long-term impact is. So I think some of the concerns that people have about the social cost of marijuana, they're difficult to determine even 5 years after legalization.
That surprised me. I guess I thought there'd be, you know, things that could be tracked as far as traffic accidents or whether more people are consuming marijuana. So it's an interesting understanding to say, no, you know what, that's harder to track than we might think.
Certainly more marijuana is being sold now than there was before legalization, but we don't know how many of those are tourists. The usage rates, the surveys that the health department does have not changed that much. There was a lot of marijuana in Denver before legalization. We had a very robust medical market in the city, about 200 medical stores. Now there's 200 stores that sell recreational. So in some ways, it was a change in name mostly, and that really benefited tourists because you didn't need a Colorado ID to be a part of the recreational market like you did with medical. So we just don't know.
Ben, overall, what were the big surprises? What was not anticipated?
I think the growth of edibles, the popularity of edibles. Now, these are chocolate bars, caramel corn, anything you can imagine can be turned into some form of edible marijuana. Those were extremely popular and still very popular in Colorado. And I think that's in part a byproduct of the fact that we don't have a place that people can go to use marijuana publicly. Like, there are no marijuana bars in Denver. I think there's maybe one or two in the state that are operating, but sometimes they're operating in a gray area. It's just not widespread. And so if you travel here and you want to use marijuana, you don't have a private residence, you can't use it outside or on the street, edibles are a very popular option for that demographic. And so I think that the reason that's important is because the state had to come to terms with educating people how to use edible marijuana, because it's an easy way to overdo it. You can, once you get too much marijuana in your stomach, you can't get it back out again, and you just kind of live out the bad trip. Whereas if you smoke marijuana, the effects are more immediate. You can kind of regulate yourself. It was about packaging too, figuring out packaging that let people know, parents and teachers, that this chocolate wasn't just any ordinary chocolate, but one that carried marijuana with it.
Ben, what would you say are the most concerning problems regarding pot in Colorado right now?
I think that finding good ways to measure impairment is a huge problem right now. We have a standard for impairment for driving. It's 5 nanograms per milliliter of blood. It's just not a good scientific standard because marijuana does not metabolize in the system like alcohol, right? So alcohol, we have a pretty good sense of how much you drink, how much you weigh, how much time has it been since your last drink, and we can tell impairment. There's breathalyzers can give a pretty good measure of impairment on the roadside. There just isn't anything like that for marijuana, so we don't even know the true extent of the problem. And so developing some kind of easy roadside test, right now they use drug recognition experts or a blood draw, and both of those things are difficult and expensive. So those are definitely things that, you know, there just doesn't seem to be any solution on the horizon. And so it makes it difficult to measure and to keep people off the roads.
Ben, people touted legal pot as a way to raise revenue, you know, solve budget problems. Did that happen in Colorado?
No. And I've heard this a lot. It's a common talking point in legalization election strategy, but it's never going to solve any budget problem. In Colorado, our state budget is more than $20 billion a year, and Colorado brings in about $250 million a year in marijuana tax revenue. So it really pales in comparison. I mean, it's $250 million they didn't have before legalization, right? So it does pay for some things. In Denver, they've built rec centers that they couldn't build otherwise. I think the larger economic impact is not necessarily in the tax revenue that's paid directly on purchases, but in the fact that marijuana businesses have filled nearly every square foot of warehouse space in the Denver metro area. The fact that they've filled many of the retail spaces that were closing because of the change to e-commerce. I think that the impact of having 20,000 workers in the state in an industry, a $2 billion almost a year industry that all the states around us do not have, I think that definitely has a positive economic impact. Now, people who are against marijuana will tell you that maybe it has a negative impact in that people are using drugs rather than working, but we're not seeing that. We're not seeing workers not participating because of marijuana.
Ben, broadly speaking, can you sense whether there's been any regret among people in Colorado at having legal cannabis?
No, in fact, I think it's the opposite. So the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, he came out against marijuana in 2012 before the election. He said, Colorado is known for many great things, and marijuana should not be one of them. It was a strong statement. But he has said since then that he was wrong, that the industry can be regulated, they can be good business citizens in the community, that it can be done in a responsible way. And so I think even some of the harshest critics have come around. Now, there certainly are groups, especially a group of concerned parents who are organized, who have consistently tried to put more restrictions on the industry. But even the people who are the most against marijuana in Colorado talk more in terms of increased restrictions rather than going back to a time before legalization.
Ben Marcus, Colorado Public Radio, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me again.
These are queasy times for the auto industry. President Trump declares himself tariff man and makes economic policy in 280-character tweets. The stock market sliding this week over renewed doubts about the U.S.-China trade truce. And automakers are wrestling with how to meet the auto 2.0 challenges of mobility, autonomy, and electrification. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. Let's start, Daniel, with GM Chairman Mary Barra's trip to Capitol Hill Wednesday. How much heat did she face, and what did we learn?
Well, we haven't learned a lot because she hasn't changed her tune, which is what I expected. You have a lot of lawmakers from Ohio and Michigan particularly raising holy hell over these plans to idle plants next year in those two states, saying that we rescued you during the dark times and now you owe us. And I think Mary Barr is coming back and saying, no, we don't. What we need to do is make sure to safeguard that investment by the American taxpayers. We need to make sure this company is viable going forward. And I think it's fair to say pretty unapologetic about the decisions they're having to make. And we at the Detroit News have been doing a lot of additional reporting on top of that news last week about exactly why this is happening. And it's very interesting when you start to dig into it. The General Motors plants are not utilized nearly as much as plants from Ford and Fiat Chrysler, for example. There's a whole lot of reasons that are driving GM's decisions. And when you have plants that aren't fully utilized, that's just a huge drain on cash. And all of these companies, not just General Motors, are looking for ways to turn their core business into cash that they can then invest in, as you put it at the top, auto 2.0 technologies.
And speaking of utilization of plants and issues, Toyota North America's CEO Jim Lentz spoke Wednesday in Detroit. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from him?
Well, it's a very upbeat guy, a very optimistic guy. But I learned a couple of things that I think I already suspected, is that Toyota, for one, doesn't have a capacity problem in North America. Its plants are running somewhere in the mid-90 percentile, which anybody listening could figure out that 100% means you're fully utilized. And you can get over 100% if you're using extra shifts and things like that. But in general, companies need to run at 80% or higher. He also is not leaving the car business, like GM and Ford and Chrysler, Fiat Chrysler. He's staying in the car business. They're going to continue to do the Camry. They're going to continue to do the Corolla. Because when you've got players that leave the field, guess what? Even you've got a diminishing market share in the car share, you have the ability to get a bigger chunk of what's left. And the Japanese and the Koreans clearly are not going to leave that segment. They may pare a little bit in a few places because some of the segments within the car segments are very challenged, like really small cars, for example. Mm-hmm. But they're not going to leave. That's their bread and butter. That's how those companies made it in the U.S. market initially, on the backs of things like the Honda Civic, the Honda Accord, the Toyota Camry, the Toyota Corolla.
As you say in your column today, boring times, it's not. You have the tariff man, our president, using 19th century tactics, as you point out, to reshape an industry that's plunging into 21st century technology.
That's exactly right. And I think the tariffs are, these guys are pulling their hair out over this, and in part because there's no certainty. They are caught in the middle of a grand negotiating strategy by this president. And I think they don't know where it's going to go. They've got three things they're really concerned about. One is import tariffs. If you're a German or a Japanese manufacturer, you do build some of your cars that you sell in the U.S. outside the U.S. And if those cars are coming in, it's going to raise prices. You just have a whole host of issues that they're dealing with here, whether or not the successor to NAFTA. Will Congress pass it, a new Congress, or will they say, no, we want changes? And the president says, no, I'm not changing it. Either you take this or I'm out. And the United States is out. And their fear is if the United States pulls out altogether of the new agreement or the old NAFTA, then the market really has some problems. Jim Lentz from Toyota yesterday said they would project that the market would lose about 2 million units in sales if that were to happen.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes writing about the fact these are not boring times for auto companies. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Still to come, lame duck bills could change how we track money in politics, but there's a possible conflict of interest for a bill's primary sponsor.
How in the world can he be chairman, lead sponsor on the legislation, and expect this to pass when he has broken that law himself?
That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Close your eyes for a moment and listen. Now, imagine a small ensemble performing that merry foxtrot. An ensemble of musicians who are prisoners wearing gray-striped uniforms, performing for their Nazi captors at the Auschwitz concentration camp. That arrangement you're hearing was done by the prisoners and then discovered decades later by University of Michigan music theory professor Patricia Hall. And because of her efforts, this arrangement is being heard for the first time in more than 75 years. It's a pleasure, Patricia Hall, to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you. It's a pleasure as well.
I have to tell you, I listen to that foxtrot, and every time I hear it, I cry. I think of prisoners who arranged this music, performed this music, happy music, in a place where some 1.1 million people were murdered by the Nazis.
And I have to confess, after all this time, I have a similar reaction to it. It's filled with so much joy, so much euphoria, and then you think about that setting and that those prisoners were somehow able to be musicians and express that music.
Tell us how you uncovered this arrangements and what led you to the Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum and in the archives.
So it's a little bit, I think, like investigative reporting where you hear something from someone. So I was given a tip from someone who worked in the Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial Museum, and they told me they thought there might be manuscripts there, or perhaps there was just pencil annotations on some printed music. So that encouraged me enough, and I was certainly curious, that I decided to visit the archive and take a look for myself.
To be a scholar.
Exactly.
Yes, to apply your training as a scholar.
Yes.
And so how long until you found something, and what did you find?
Well, I was very lucky because, as those of us who work in archives know, you can look for a very, very long time through lots and lots of materials and find nothing. And it's a unique situation in Auschwitz-Birkenau in that I was told by one of the directors there that only 5% of the documents from the camp have survived. So I was handed stacks of cards to look through, and almost immediately I was seeing titles like Love Letters That Never Arrived, or Sing a Song When You're Sad, or the title of the foxtrot that we performed at U of M, The Most Beautiful Time of Life. And anybody working in an archive is certainly used to coming across very personal documents. It could be medical records. It could be illicit love letters. You name it, we've seen it. But I just had to stop what I was doing. I was just so emotionally affected by this. And so I just stopped for a minute. And at that point, as soon as I saw that title, The Most Beautiful Time of Life, I decided, okay, I've got to investigate this piece of music.
And you ultimately find an arrangement. And this, The Most Beautiful Time of Life, is what we heard at the beginning of our conversation. And so these were not original compositions, right? But the arrangers must have had some very severe constraints.
Absolutely. So they were arranging music, very often popular songs. So The Most Beautiful Time of Life, Die Schönste Zeit des Lebens, for instance, was composed in 1941. And it was by this very popular film composer. So they chose that piece, but they had to arrange it for their ensemble. And one of the first things that also struck me when I actually got to see the manuscript was the extremely unusual instrumentation. And so this piece—
Because that was what he had to work with.
That's it, yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. So they, in addition to a full-size symphony orchestra that played in Auschwitz I and played Sunday concerts in front of the Hus Villa, in front of the Commandant's Villa, they had a small jazz band of about 20 members. And so, you know, you're talking about, for this ensemble, it's 9 violins, 2 clarinets, a trombone, and a tuba. And so I must say, as taken as I was by this piece, I worried what it might sound like with that combination of instruments.
And now, as we've heard it, it's glorious.
It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. And these were very talented musicians, some of them conservatory trained. And there's all sorts of stories about musicians who ended up caught up in the Holocaust, and they ended up in Auschwitz-Birkenau, whether they're a member of like a Vienna Philharmonic or some prodigy like Henry Meyer, the founder of the LaSalle String Quartet. So this is Auschwitz I, the main camp, and these are very talented arrangers. Some of them have backgrounds in singing popular music. And so in many ways, they've got exactly the right training. So I couldn't quite imagine what this piece would sound like, and I was equally astounded when I heard it rehearsed for the first time.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan music theory professor Patricia Hall about the manuscript she found at Auschwitz-Birkenau Museum and Archives that was the arrangement of a foxtrot played for the German commanders by a prisoner ensemble called The Most Beautiful Time of Life. Were you able to figure out who the arrangers were and what might have become of them?
Yeah, so that was one of the mysteries and something I was extremely interested in. And again, I have to say I was very fortunate in that in this manuscript, two of the three Polish political prisoners signed their prisoner number. And that in itself is significant. They don't sign their name, they sign their prisoner number. And at Auschwitz-Birkenau, of course, they have detailed records of the names associated with these numbers, when they were admitted to Auschwitz-Birkenau, when they were transferred to another camp, or in the case of one of the arrangers, Antoni Gargul, when he was released. He was released in 1943.
We don't think of anyone getting out. That's
no,
that fascinating.
No, that was the first time I realized people were actually released. Not many,
yeah.
But some were released, yeah.
But we also can only imagine that the musicians who played for these Sunday concerts for their captors, many did not make it out. You were able to get this music transcribed for students to play. You performed it recently for an audience. And I think of the musicians who last performed this music, the prisoners, and the audience listening, the Nazi garrison at Auschwitz, two sides of this same equation.
Absolutely. And I must say, this concert was tremendously uplifting for all of us. We had a more than capacity crowd for this, where we needed to usher some people into the student lounge so they could watch it. We also made the decision to simulcast the performance because I received email from lots of people in other states who had heard about this through the AP article, and they were saying, how can I listen to this performance? And it was beautifully taped.
Yes, well, it is stunning. Now, I know that you found other manuscripts. Are you planning to go through this with more manuscripts, or is it somebody else's job to do?
Right. So I keep thinking about this, and it's been very helpful going through the experience of hearing this one piece performed, working with so many incredibly talented people at U of M, and talking to people about this project. So I'm beginning to think that I will go back in May and investigate some of these other pieces.
I could see a very powerful album if there was enough to be able to do that, because you can tell that it speaks to people, and it's almost like a flower blooming in the midst of that desolation of Auschwitz.
Yeah, that's a perfect way to describe it.
Well, again, University of Michigan music theory professor Patricia Hall, who unearthed the arrangement of this foxtrot, The Most Beautiful Time of Life, performed in Auschwitz by prisoners who will live on because of the work you've done. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And now to Lansing for more news out of Lame Duck, this time about money in politics and a potential conflict of interest for a Republican senator. There are bills moving through the state Senate now that would alter campaign finance laws. One would strip campaign finance oversight from the Secretary of State and hand that over to a new independent commission made up of three Democrats and three Republicans. The primary sponsor of the bill is Senator Dave Robertson, a Republican from Grand Blanc. Robertson has been repeatedly sanctioned for campaign finance spending violations since 2012. He still owes the state nearly $1,700 in fines. With us now is John Gleason, a former state representative, former state senator, now the Genesee County Clerk. He is a Democrat. John, what are your concerns with these bills taking campaign finance authority away from the incoming Secretary of State?
Well, it shouldn't be the individual that's been the most non-compliant with state regulations. I took an oath to uphold the law. One Michigan law is that you must be compliant with election law and you must be compliant with campaign finance law. To me, this is no different than if Fort Knox was to hire John Dillinger to head of security. You can't have someone that broke the law trying to change the law, so it becomes easier to not be compliant.
Are you concerned more with who is sponsoring this law, or what about the law itself? What about what it would do, taking this authority away from the incoming Secretary of State?
They're one and the same, because taking the authority away turns it into the hands of politicians. You're going to select three individuals from both sides, and they are going to be designated as Democrats and Republicans. First of all, you're going to bind it up in the partisanship of the commission itself. Secondly, there's no difference because the person that's trying to change the law is the one that broke the law. That's never a good route to go down. We haven't had a Democratic Secretary of State since Richard Austin. So the Republicans have had this administrative responsibility for a quarter of a century. Now when the keys are being turned over to a responsible individual, Jocelyn Benson, remember, she ran on harder to cheat, easier to vote. They know that she will hold these scofflaws accountable. So they know that people like Robertson were going to have to ante up or else they're going to have to answer to the public.
How would you describe the enforcement of campaign finance laws in general in our state?
Great question. I'm looking at nearly $100,000 in outstanding fines and fees sitting on my desk right now from Genesee County candidates and committees. We get absolutely zero support from the state of Michigan enforcing and collecting these fines and fees. We have office holders here in Genesee County very similar to Robertson. We have township officials that are holding office that owe hundreds of dollars. One in particular that comes off the top of my mind, a township supervisor, owed $700 while serving in office. And our responsibility, because we have no investigative nor police powers, we must advance these concerns to the state. Ultimately, the Attorney General has the final say after the Secretary of State determines whether it's worth looking at. But I have $100,000 from local candidates and committees that's not collectible because the state doesn't do their job. Jocelyn Benson, I met with her in August. She said, I promise you I'll make this a priority, that we hold them accountable, that we collect the fines, but more importantly, we collect them earlier so they don't build up.
Now, we did speak with the Secretary of State's office, and a spokesman told us that the office is not legally able to get involved in county campaign finance issues. He says it's the county's duty to collect fees and the Attorney General's responsibility to address violations of the law. What's your understanding of how the Secretary of State can be helpful in this situation?
Well, I know that we're not getting any support now because that's the attitude of the current administration. But I can give you my word. I'm looking at it right now. It's campaign finance, notice of late filing fee that is due. My letterhead that I send to these election officers is a letterhead from the Michigan Department of State Bureau of Elections. This is the process that's used. We use their letterhead to tell these scofflaws that they must pay their debt and close out their accounts. So they have a very important role. I know that if Jocelyn Benson was a Secretary of State, but she made that commitment to me personally, if I call her and say, look, at which we do, we have $8,000 and $12,000 debtors. If I call Jocelyn Benson up and say, look, we have to do something about this, I give you my word that Jocelyn would make sure that this debt was eliminated. She would work strongly with the new Attorney General to make sure those folks that owe the public money and have missed their deadlines would be held accountable.
Now, Republican State Senator Dave Robertson is, as we say, primary sponsor of the bill. He did not return the message we left with his office requesting comment. He was asked about the campaign violations, about the fines, and he insists, and I'm quoting him here, he has complied with the state law. And he also says he's the right person to introduce this bill because he's chairman of the election committee. What are your thoughts?
He should not be chairman. When he broke the law in 2012, he should have been removed as chairman of that committee. No question. You don't have a lawbreaker that heads any committee. Probably shouldn't even be in office if you don't uphold the Constitution of your state. The Constitution is the law. Secondly, he should not introduce the bill while he's still under fine. He owes a debt now, in the minimum. Why don't you clear up your personal obligation and worry about other people? If he's so concerned about Michigan doing the right thing, why doesn't he as an individual take care of his nearly $1,700 debt? Then he is afforded a voice. Right now, he's just an empty gong because there's no accountability. When you have somebody that just turns their back on the law and he can write one that alters the enforcement, he's more concerned about his own standing. I promise you, he's concerned about burying his own debt. He's 3 weeks away from leaving office. Got $58,000 in this personal campaign committee. He can remove that $1,700 and go pay that debt and be free of that obligation. and then he has an opportunity to have a voice in this process. How in the world can he be chairman, lead sponsor on the legislation, and expect this to pass when he has broken that law himself?
And just one final quick question. From your view as a county clerk, as a former state lawmaker, what would this Fair Political Practices Commission mean to Michigan if it's put in place?
It will mean the same thing that the Board of Canvassers do. As we have a contentious question go before the Board of Canvassers, it's typically tied two Republicans, two Democrats, they tie 2-2, and then it goes to the court. So it's going to be a greater expense to the public because very little contentious issues. If there's any confusion on the issue going before the commission, they're going to side with their partisan leanings. And then once again, we're going to have to bring in judge in, just like we did with the last questions that were placed before the voters in Michigan. So it's another layer of expense to the taxpayers. But first of all, there's not a single voter in the state of Michigan that's concerned about altering the way that we are doing the collection of fines and fees. They're concerned about the roads. They're concerned about health care. They're concerned about education. This is what the people are against. I promise you that people in this state elected Jocelyn Benson to drain the swamp of scoff laws like Robertson. Robertson is very concerned that you'll have somebody like Benson. Remember, after he leaves office, he's going to still owe that debt. And Jocelyn Benson would be in a position to collect that debt, his and others.
Genesee County Clerk John Gleason, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Hey, from Genesee County, thank you for the opportunity.
Up next, an MSU economist causing a stir with research showing astronomical accounting irregularities at the Pentagon. His work's gone viral thanks to a recent article in The Nation. After the break, we talk with the journalist who wrote the piece and the MSU professor who inspired it. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Pentagon's massive accounting fraud exposed how U.S. military spending keeps rising even as the Pentagon flunks audit. That was the headline of an article published last week in The Nation. And the article's gotten the attention of quite a few Washington politicians and a lot of journalists. And with us now is the man who wrote the piece for The Nation, Dave Lindorf. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me on.
And with us is Mark Skidmore, an economics professor at Michigan State University. His years-long research on the Pentagon's budget irregularities formed the basis for Dave's story. Welcome back to Stateside, Mark. Good to have you here.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks again for having us.
So, Dave, you start your piece by pointing out last month the Pentagon failed its first ever audit. How did that happen?
In 1990, Congress passed a law called the CFO Act, which mandates all federal entities that have a budget have to make it auditable, and they submit to audits every year for outside audits. Gradually, they've all worked to the point where they all are in compliance with that order, except for one agency, and that happens to be the Pentagon, which also is the largest single line item in the federal budget, with 54% of your tax dollars going to the Pentagon. And they were supposed to be in compliance by, I think, 1996. And they've stonewalled. The way this audit happened is Congress finally just threw up their hands and said, you're going to do the audit. They allocated $900 million to hire outside auditors led by EY, used to be called Ernst & Young. 1,200 auditors went through Pentagon books for a year, and they came up with nothing. The only things they were able to audit well, and this is significant, is the retirement plan and the payroll.
Wow. Mark, give us a recap of how you came to discover Pentagon's auditing irregularities and what you found.
Sure. I had been listening to an interview with a former government official, Catherine Austin Fitch. She's a former Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under Bush number one. And she had referred to a report produced by the Office of the Inspector General, the OIG, for the Army. And in fiscal year 2015, the Army had $122 billion authorized spending budget. But the OIG report indicated that it had $6.5 trillion with a T in unsupported adjustments. These are essentially transactions that our own government officials say they cannot verify. I have a background in public budgeting and public finance, and I just thought, that's not possible. $122 billion budget, $6.5 trillion in unsupported adjustments. So I found the report myself on the OIG website, and I started reading it, and I had a lot of questions. I contacted Catherine, and we decided to work together. I asked some of my graduate students to pour through thousands of documents on government websites, especially the OIG website. And what we compiled was incomplete, but we found that our own government records indicate $21 trillion in transactions that cannot be verified.
When you say transactions, so this is all in-house. This is, I have some money here, but I'm going to slide it over to that pot, and then from that pot to another pot. Is that what's kind of happening, where you can't follow where this all went?
With these summary reports, I don't know. There are some examples that just don't make sense, but they're so vague, it's hard to determine. This captured Dave's attention.
Well, let me say that I actually got attracted to this story first in 2016 with that same $6.5 trillion number. When it first came out, it sort of was out there in the alternative media, and I read it, and I thought, geez, how come I'm not reading about that in the Times and the Post and seeing it on CBS? That's a huge number, and it doesn't make any sense. I wasn't even looking at the Army part. I was looking at the Pentagon budget was about $500 billion, and then they had this $6.5 trillion figure in the budget. So I did a piece for FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, about that. It was called The Pentagon Money Pit, and I was trying to figure out, mainly a media review article, why doesn't the mainstream press even look into this number? And in the course of that, I interviewed a press officer, the top press officer for the Defense Department's Office of Inspector General, a woman named Bridget Sirchak. So she told me, oh, these adjustments are just what accountants normally do with public companies. You know, they round things up. And she gave me an example of part of the Army budget where there was a total on one part of the budget that was $0.2 billion, and it was changed to $90 billion, and she called that rounding.
That's quite a rounding.
Geez, that is really not right. So I put that in the piece, and, you know, I don't know what it was either. Reacted the same way Mark did. And then Mark came out with his study that said that that was just one example, and that between 1998 and 2015, all those various OIG reports on different aspects of the Pentagon budget had these weird numbers, you know, and I'm going to use the term plugged because that's the Pentagon's term, plugs in their budget that are really numbers that don't have underlying supporting ledger entries to explain them.
So they're, as you put them in your piece, they're phony numbers.
Well, that was my conclusion,
yeah.
And that was based not on my own thinking, but on interviews I had with some key people. Asif Khan, who I interviewed on the record at the GAO, who heads the National Security Asset Management Unit of the GAO that monitors, you know, the Pentagon budget, the CIA budget, those various national security budgets, Energy Department. Then I also got it from Mark Armstrong, who's a very key figure because he spent 6 years as the supervising director of audits for the OIG, which is the internal auditor for the Pentagon. And he said these numbers that the Pentagon submits to Congress are garbage, and they should tell Congress when they submit them, we're giving you this, but it's all garbage. So I just thought, wow.
You know? Yeah, that's...
In fact, you know, they say that some of these numbers were supported and some were not. And I asked him about that because he had that written in a report that he filed for the OIG on, I think it was the 2015 budget. And he said, well, yeah, but supported in that context meant that they were signed off on by the proper senior official, not that the ledger documents supported them. So even supported doesn't mean supported.
I'm talking with Dave Lindorf, whose piece for The Nation is titled The Pentagon's Massive Accounting Fraud Exposed, and also talking with Mark Skidmore, economics professor at Michigan State University. We have talked with him before on Stateside about his research on the Pentagon's budget irregularities. And Mark, when you found these budget irregularities that add up to $21 trillion, these transactions between 1998 and 2015, couldn't be traced, couldn't be documented, you go to the Pentagon and ask about it, reach out to the Department of Defense. How did it respond?
Well, I just wasn't able to get anywhere, and I really emphasized trying to reach out to the Office of the Inspector General because most of the reports are produced by them. And I was not able to get any real feedback or information. At one point, they just stopped responding to my emails and questions. You know, I'm not an insider. What I'm trying to do is, as a researcher, look at these and try to ask reasonable questions that we all should have answers to. And so I was not able to get any additional information from the Office of the Inspector General. And as highlighted in Dave's article, the most recent report for the Navy was fully redacted. So now, you know, one cannot even ask those kinds of questions. And
am I right that the Office's Inspector General actually pulled reports down from the website?
They did pull reports off. It's not clear whether they were revamping their website or what. So that they were removed for a time and then put back on under new URLs. So I leave it to your listeners to determine what that means. I don't know.
And David,
but they came back censored. Not the old ones, but the new stuff is being censored, apparently.
The thing that I found interesting in your piece, Dave Lindorf, was after the Pentagon flunked its audit, its one and only audit that came years too late, 1,200 auditors kind of threw up their hands. Describe for us the reaction about failing the audit that you cite in your story from the Deputy Defense Secretary, Patrick Shanahan.
Yeah, no, he came on and he said, well, we failed the audit, but we expected to fail the audit. And besides, we should get credit for doing this because, you know, it's a big budget and we should be getting credit for trying. But no reporters asked him about the fact that they'd been stonewalling for 26 years and refusing to do the audit. That's a little, you know, self-congratulatory to say you should get credit for waiting 26 years and then doing it. You know, the excuses they've given for not doing an audit, my favorite is their mean one, is they say, well, look, we have these legacy systems and they don't talk to each other. They've been saying that for 26 years. When they started, I was using a K-Pro computer with, you know, I think it was 64K internal memory. And, you know, they've had so much money thrown at them every year that they could have bought, I don't know, how many Watson computers and had this thing done. But basically what I'm told by, you know, Chuck Spinney and Mark Armstrong and other people that are inside the Pentagon is it's clear that the Pentagon does not want to be audited, has not wanted to be audited, and you know, going forward does not want to be audited.
And Dave, in your piece, you called what the Pentagon's been doing a fraud. And we see businesses shuffling money from one pot to another and back again, the old borrowing from Peter to pay Paul adage. What is different here? What do you see as a fraud?
Well, because they're making up the numbers, they're not, unless, you know, Mark has a suspicion that some of it is real, and there's some evidence of that. I mean, he cited one that I think is really indicative, was in the Army budget. There's one area where they say they have 900 and some billion dollars in accounts payable. This is on a budget of $122 billion. They have $900 billion in accounts payable, and then they also have on the same page incoming funds transferred from the Treasury to the Army account of $724 billion. I mean, these are enormous numbers. I tried to get the Treasury to tell me whether there was, in fact, from their end, $700 billion that was transferred to the Army account. They never responded. Even the PR department wouldn't respond to me. My suspicion is that there is no connecting transfer from the Treasury of that amount of money. That's a huge sum that's bigger than the Pentagon budget that year, transferred supposedly to the Army. And the idea that that would somehow not show up in many other ways as being, you know, used. And they don't identify the accounts payable, of course, in this other number.
If I may.
So, you know, so these are definitely curiosities that should be the subject of a massive Pentagon hearing with the parties put under oath. And that's what's not happening.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to add another example. And this is one that I've been harping on since we did the interview last December, Cindy. Mm-hmm. Not harping, but pulling on the string, if you will, because I felt this was a question that the Office of the Inspector General could provide an answer to. And there were, in that same report for the Army and the $6.5 trillion in unsupported adjustments, there were 170 transactions that the OIG says are unsupported unverified transactions amounting to $2.1 trillion. And that's such a huge number, $2.1 trillion and 170 transactions. After I did the interview with you, the OIG responded to your inquiry and said, we'd be happy to provide more information. And I said, well, you know, forget about the $800 billion transfer from Treasury or the $900 billion in accounts payable, et cetera, but just provide an addendum or a spreadsheet, maybe even post it online so that we can see what those 170 adjustments were for. That's about $12 billion per adjustment on average.
Mm-hmm.
Those numbers are so huge that I have trouble understanding how they could just be made up numbers or plugs. And so, and this is where Dave and I have a different view. I've said, we cannot know if they're plugs or if maybe there really are huge amount of money flowing in and flowing out of the DOD until we actually have access to the underlying data. And I've tried to be consistent in that message as I've talked about this and written about it. You know, what does it actually represent? And we get these general responses. At this point, my confidence and trust is low. You know, sometimes we have to take people at their word. You know, we think they're trustworthy. But at this point, I just want to see actual underlying data points. And that was one I felt the OIG could provide in a, you know, less than a day's effort, and they won't provide it.
Now, Mark, you and your team, as we said, found a total of $21 trillion of DOD financial transactions that couldn't be traced or documented. And then this really blew up when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the progressive representative-elect from New York, helped this blow up and go viral by incorrectly tweeting that the $21 trillion could have paid for two-thirds of the estimated cost for so-called Medicare for All. Mark, what did she get wrong? What did she misunderstand?
Well, I think Dave and I would have slightly different interpretations. My thing is, well, part of this could be what Dave says. It's just all made up numbers. And part of it could be, well, maybe there really are large amounts of money flowing. We just don't know. We need to have an inquiry, you know, under oath, and we need to see the data. And my take on it is whether you're sort of on the left or the right, you still need rule of law and you need to follow. And so then we can worry about how we spend money and what we do if we have a level of transparency and rule of law that we can all agree on.
What's your take on her tweet, Dave?
Well, I think what she got wrong was she assumed that it was a pot of money that had been spent over that period of time. That was not either Mark's or my assertion. And by the way, I think Mark would agree with me on this. The plugs or the numbers are on both sides of the ledger sheet. Some of the numbers are for assets coming in, and some of them are liabilities going out. You know, money spent, money received. So even if it were real money, it wouldn't be $21 trillion in real money. On the other hand, the numbers that Mark looked at are only a fraction of the Pentagon's budget, because the OIG, whose documents he was looking at, only audits parts of the Pentagon budget each year, or reviews parts of the budget. One year they did the Marines, one year they did the Army, one year they did the Navy. And so the whole vast parts of the Pentagon budget don't get looked at by the OIG every year. So there could be even vastly more of these numbers.
Actually, that's absolutely right. We really don't know how many of these transactions.
And as we see from reading your piece, Dave Lindorf, in The Nation, that Congress has not asked very many questions about this and mentioned the Budget and Armed Services Committees specifically. Have you gotten any assurances from senators or House representatives that someone's going to look into this, someone's going to take this more seriously?
You know, the response to this has been so pathetic, I can't believe it. That first of all, you know, when Mark's research came out, that got some attention. At least it got into Forbes, you know, a consequential magazine. Nobody in Congress has said, geez, we got to look at this. They just had the hearings in the fall on the 2019 budget. Not a word came up about this.
Dave Lindorf, contributor to The Nation, and Mark Skidmore, Michigan State University economist. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We reached out to Michigan's U.S. senators for comment. The statement from Senator Gary Peters, a ranking member of the Federal Spending Oversight Subcommittee and a member of the Armed Services Committee, reads in part, and I quote, "It is vital that we ensure America's servicemen and women have the resources to execute their mission safely and effectively. However, I remain very concerned with how the Department of Defense has struggled to keep track of funds, and the military must put in place a modern and efficient accounting system. Michigan's other senator, Debbie Stabenow, who sits on the Senate Budget Committee, did not respond to our requests. There is a lot to unpack here. For those of you who want to know more about the Pentagon's budget irregularities, head over to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org, and you can hear an extended conversation with Lindorf and Skidmore. It includes a discussion about a recent push to allow departments with secret budgets, including HUD, to be even more secretive. And that's Stateside for today. Thank you so very much for listening.